Yeah, so firstly, welcome. We're going to talk about ILS analytics and operational excellence within the insurance market. I think sort of I've been involved in the whole ILS space since it really began in the early 90s and seen a lot of real progress in terms of the market, in terms of the use of analytics and the development of the market. And we're going to talk about some of the things which have been really positive and some of the things that really haven't changed within the last 20 years and where we could see efficiencies coming into the space to really improve things. I think the market's learned many lessons in the last 25 years. There's also been a significant advancement in risk analytics. But as we look to the future, the market is facing many new challenges. I think we're seeing increased risk complexity. We're seeing factors such as climate change, social inflation coming into the market, to mention a few. We also see a lot of operational challenges to the adoption of the appropriate risk management capabilities within the ILS space. We all say within Moody's that where we see risk, we see opportunity, and one of our roles is to unlock that opportunity for market participants. And we see within the ILS space that we see a lot more demand for ILS, but we also see a rapid pace of change in the risk analytics and the associated technology. And the question that we have, and we're covering both in this session and in the panel, is really how we can marry those two together. And do we ask the question, do we have the right operational excellence to capture this significant opportunity? There are many different flavors of ILS funds, from the pure cat bond funds, collateralized reinsurance, to hybrid capabilities, and the private ILS that we've talked about this morning. There are also a lot of different strategies and different views of what great actually looks like. There are different approaches to risk analytics as well. We've got the top-down aggregate perspective. We've got the bottom-up modeling perspective, similar to the way that reinsurers model risk. And we've got a lot of others within the market using a lot of market data to calibrate their portfolio. And really, when I look at this whole space, I'd say it's a real patchwork of third-party risk analytics. We can improve, and we can create, sort of ILS funds can really work together with us to really create their own views of risk. From our perspective, we're investing heavily. We invested a number of years ago in a new type of modeling capability, modeling techniques, our high-definition models, to tackle some of the really complex risks like wildfire, floods, and severe convective storms. We also have invested significantly in technology to allow those models to be used directly into workflows and ease workflow efficiencies. We've now got over 325 customers on our intelligent risk platform, our technology platform, to unlock the power of those models. We're running about 7 to 8 billion of locations a month through that platform. So it's really now embedded within the reinsurance industry. It's an API-first technology, so it can really integrate into workflows. And the work that we're doing now is working with a lot of the leading ILS funds to look at how we can unlock that technology, unlock that modeling capability, and how it can be used to transform the whole ILS space. When we look at sort of the how do we support operational risk excellence, we put on here sort of a number of points in and really asking the question, what should you expect from your analytics providers? What you should expect is a continuous improvement in views of risk. Views of risk which were developed 5-10 years ago are no longer valid given factors such as climate change, exposure changes, and sort of social inflation, legal changes, and so on. You should expect your analytics provider to deliver consistent, reliable analytics with technology to match. You should expect your analytics provider to provide API-first technology to integrate it seamlessly into your workflows, and also to recognize that one size does not fit all. I say these are all attributes of analytics providers, And I was a customer of many of these, the analytics providers, for 25 years through the prior part of my career. And I can certainly say that the providers, including RMS, I didn't get this right every time. But you've got our commitment that we'll work together with the industry to get this right in future. We're investing heavily within the technologies and the models science that I've described. But what I'd ask from you is that I'd ask you to consume the capabilities and the models and the science from source to get the latest view of risks. Not from press articles or anecdotes that you hear in the market about calibration. A good example of this was sort of some of the changes that we made to our view on North American hurricane risk. When we observed changes within both the science, the legal environment, social inflation, exposure, and so on, in 2022, we introduced two views of risk in that space. We had a baseline view and an alternative view, where we wanted to start a discussion with the industry about what we were observing within the market from the claims that we would see. And so we started that conversation. We brought together all of the stakeholders in the industry around a changing view of risk that we were seeing. We brought that back together in version 23, which we released last year. And we spent a lot of time with the different stakeholders in the market, educating them about the changes, what we're seeing in terms of exposure, some of the legal changes that had happened and some that had gone away. We spent a lot of time on the education. We see that as really our role. And it was slightly disappointing that sort of earlier this year that we started to see a number of press articles and so on expressing surprise from some of the customers, some of the stakeholders in the industry about some of the changes. But if we're not getting it right, we want you to tell us so that we can improve their education and we can improve those pieces in future. When I look to the future and how we can improve this operational excellence and really create the best possible market, I think we all need to have a really proactive engagement to unlock this market opportunity. We start off with disclosure. There's the old adage that better data equals better results. We don't have great quality data within the ILS space. We've got some ideas how we can improve that. We really need to sort of work with the market to really understand how risk is changing and the model quality and why model quality is really important. We also need to be working together as an industry and driving innovation. And one of the questions that we've got, what are really the right forums for these conversations? Because one of these forums is through this Artemis conference, but what are the right forums that we can engage in going forward? So the question on better data is, why does it actually matter? So what we thought we would do is give you an example here where we ran 27 typical US hurricane insurance portfolios and remodeled those as if they were cat bond county, if we had them as cat bond county level disclosures to show the difference in results that we would get. For residential lines, we saw sort of, if this is on one of the probability metrics, but we saw results which were between 23 and 183% higher on residential lines if you're modeling on county level as opposed to the actual losses, actual sort of data that you could get from the company. On commercial lines, we saw it between 20% below and 70% above, overall lines between 1 and 82% above. And the point of this is that if we're modeling at this aggregated level, at this county level, we're not getting the right granularity. We're not enabling you to appropriately balance your portfolios and to create more efficient capital that we've talked about in prior sessions. And I think what we saw in the recent couple of cyber bond issuances, well, this is where the market really got together around data quality, around providing the data, underlying data to ourselves and other providers within this space, so that the whole modeling community could come together and work with the industry to look at how we can start to expand ILS into that cyber market. And I think it's a good lesson of where we could go in the future. Model quality is really important. I think risk is evolving. We're seeing climate change, we're seeing social inflation, we're seeing a lot of exposure growth coming through. We're also seeing a lot of increasing complexity in the types of perils that we're looking at, from floods and SES and wildfire and so on, as well as our staple perils. And I think the reality of the situation is that some of the legacy models that we had sort of 5 or 10 years ago underestimate that risk, given all of the factors that I've mentioned. So we need continuous investment, and we need to continually update these models and create an up-to-date view. And we also need to sort of drive innovation through the industry. And as I say, you've got our commitment as Moody's that we're going to be driving innovation within the ILS space and also within the broader community. So we're going to make continuous investments. This is around things like easing data flows around the industry so that we can enable sort of all stakeholders to have the best quality data as they're making the different decisions. We're going to introduce, introducing on a further basis, API-first technologies, so you don't need to worry about separate applications. You integrate first into your own workflows and the own tools that you've got. We're also sort of working with the industry on new capabilities such as GenAI and really looking at questions of how can that help the industry and the ILS funds make better decisions with the high quality data that we're going to introduce. So I wanted to set the scene on the topic about how we can improve operational excellence within the business. And now I'm going to be joined by a panel of contributors from the ILS space. We've got Richard Gray, who's the head of third-party capital at Beazley, Hilary Paul, who's the partner and portfolio manager at LGT ILS Partners, Paul Wilson, who is the partner in catastrophe and climate risk at Securus, and Richard Penny, who's the CEO of Aon Securities. So please welcome them to the stage. Okay, Richard, I'll say Richard Gray. So Richard, if I can start with you. So based upon your broad financial markets experience, what do you think are the barriers to growth within the ILS market?
Well, as you say, I'm not really an insurance person. I'm a kind of an imposter as far as this room is concerned. But I have spent kind of nearly 30 years in kind of markets across a number of asset classes, and I think, ultimately liquidity begets liquidity, and I think that's the sort of, at the moment, restrictive cycle that we need to break. I was involved very early on in their sort of development, the origination and creating fund structures around private debt, and for a while that was seen as extremely niche. We were helped by the fact that central bank rates were extremely low, and therefore people were looking for that uptick in yield. And suddenly that grew almost overnight, once the publicity was there, to tens and now hundreds of billions of dollars. It's great that the ILS space is now kind of over 100 billion, of which kind of half is roughly is cat bonds. But it needs to be a lot bigger to be able to attract more investors. So we've got to really work, I think, on the supply, and that's also got to involve a degree of innovation, I think.
Good. Thank you. So, Hilary, I guess sustainability is a key topic that we've discussed, a key topic within LGT. So how do you feel about the progress in reporting of information related to sustainability, and what opportunities does it present for investors, and how do we break through, and what's the potential there?
Well, with any new regulation or reporting requirements, obviously there's a bit of time to work out all the detail, and actually for all all asset managers residing in the EU and for all funds with EU jurisdictions. 2024 is the first year of official ESG reporting. And currently, there is no real transparency or sort of conformity in how this reporting happens. It's each asset manager has had to develop their own methodology. At LGT, for instance, we've developed sort of a two-phase approach. We have, first of all, an ESG company rating, which we take from our own in-house, we call it the ESG cockpit. It's something that LGT has been developing for the past 10 years or more. It's based mainly on publicly listed companies. So each company is given an ESG rating. And then the second component of the rating is based on the exposure of the underlying reinsurance transactions. So we do this using the exposure data, EDMs, for instance, and so forth, and do a breakdown. Is it commercial, residential, industrial? Is there any fossil fuel-related exposures? And then have these two components which go into the overall ESG rating for each individual transaction, and then these get rolled up for our funds. So something certainly on the ILS side is would it be possible for the modeling agents? Obviously, they have all of the exposure information, usually on a detailed scale. Could they not provide an ESG rating, certainly on the exposure side? I think that would be something that would be quite easy and efficient for them to do. They anyway have to analyze the data, and this would, every manager is still enabled to have their own view of risk, but this would sort of give a base, a common base for reviewing all transactions. And of course, on the ESG company side, Moody's is obviously very well positioned to provide a rating. That's maybe a little bit more of a discussion in terms of cost and so forth, but I think certainly the ESG rating or some kind of a scoring that would be broadly usable for the whole industry and give everybody sort of a common base may be an interesting addition.
Yep. No, we've been very active within the ESG space within the Lloyd's market, and certainly something that we can work on to extend to the ILS space. So, yeah, certainly. I think that's somewhere where we can help. Yeah. So Richard, I guess you've been pretty active in this space for quite a while. So what's your take on the current operational process for cat bond issuance, and how can this be improved? And what would you like to see from analytics firms such as us in terms of improvement?
Yeah, I think with respect to bonds, it's probably worth taking a step back. I mean, the industry's adopted a way of structuring and putting bonds together, and that's really been consistent for 20 plus years. And I think Michael, what you're referring to is with respect to the risk modelling and the quantification of the risk associated to the bonds, where typically a client will ultimately engage one risk modelling firm to quantify the risk and return profile. And I think that's unique to cat bonds, where sort of in corporate securities and in fixed income, you may get a rating, and that rating may be an A, B, or a C. Here, what the risk modelling firms are doing is they're actually running a stochastic model to determine the true quantification of an attachment probability and the associated risk metrics. And so, you know, in many senses, the cat bonds lead the markets in that it's very specific, or the quantification of the numbers is very specific. But that being said, the overall process is around utilising one firm for an expertise risk analysis, and the way in which that data is transmitted to the risk modelling firm and then back to investors. That same process has been going on for 20 years. Mm-hmm. There hasn't been any significant development in the last couple of decades, quite frankly.
And I think that's one of the things that we need to discuss as to how the market can improve and can meet that particular challenge, given some of the things that we're seeing elsewhere across the whole industry and the way they're using analytics going forward. So turning to you, Paul, now, sort of, and thinking about sort of investor differentiation when they look at different types of ILS funds, do you think they pay attention to your ability to create your own view of risk?
I think the answer I give that is yes. We've definitely seen that in the conversation we've had and in some of the, particularly when you think about the sort of large single client mandates, that ability, the sort of the investment we've made in both research and development, but also the investment we've made in technology, that's been a really big part of the success there. And I think that's something that, that investors do look at and do scrutinize very, very closely nowadays. I think one point I'd like to maybe raise there is that that concept of a sort of own view of risk and how that's scrutinized, like our analytics is definitely moving away from that sort of, I think it's almost like too narrow a term. And we're definitely approaching that more from a thinking about it in terms of a multi-model approach to understanding risk. So we want to recognize not only the view that comes in, say, an offering circular, but also we want to understand what the alternative model might look like from that perspective. And I'd actually put the slide you showed up there about the exposure quality and that resolution of exposure. That, to me, is part of that problem as well. So you want to have a perspective not only on the differences between different vendor models, but you also want to have a perspective on the different output that you'd get depending on the resolution of the input that you get. And understanding that entire space of any investment is really, really important to us. We may not be able to see every component of that in terms of constructing that multi-model view. And we might have different levels of confidence and different levels of certainty on different perspectives of that. But we certainly want to understand that entire spectrum. And that's really where we've been focusing a lot of our sort of effort and our sort of R&D research around, is making sure that we can understand that entire spectrum of that entire sort of properly multi-model perspective on any view of risk.
And when you engage with investors, are they appreciating that, or do they line you up with those who maybe aren't on providing such that of a rich view?
I think that approach and that philosophy, and the fact that we have been able to demonstrate that approach and that philosophy, and the fact that we're able to demonstrate how that approach and that philosophy is integrated into our technology and into our decision making, has been a big differentiator with investors. That's something that they have been very receptive of when we've shown them sort of under the hood how we're approaching that.
Yeah, makes sense. So Richard Gray, just coming back to the comments that you're making about sort of growth in the barriers to growth in the ILS space, and thinking about it from the point of view of an issuer, yourself within that space, do you look at it sort of, how do you think about it in terms of the trade-offs between sort of the disclosure requirements that disclosing more data to the industry as opposed to less, and sort of, and how do you balance that with the need from the industry to obtain more data, but obviously some of that data then gets sort of published in other forums, and you're sort of maybe slightly concerned about, are you disclosing too much about your business?
Yeah, I'm smiling because I think Steve is the sort of equivalent of Robert Peston during the financial crisis. Peston used to know what the Chancellor was about to announced before the Chancellor did, and Steve seems to have the most incredible ability to pick up stories and run with them, and they tend to be pretty accurate too. I mean, look, you know, internally there was a lot of, you know, we had to do a lot of breathing exercises with some of our senior execs who, you know, who were just not comfortable, and I think some of that is perhaps due to a slight misunderstanding, because people talk about 144A and it's a public deal and all the rest of it. It's not really a public deal. That's a misnomer. It's deliberately not a public deal because the SEC don't want your average investor, your sort of retail investor, to be able to touch these things because of the view that they have of the sort of underlying riskiness. But ultimately, the information does get out there, and we really do lift our petticoats as far as that underlying data is concerned. And it does make us nervous because, you know, first of all, it's incredibly sensitive from a commercial perspective. And secondly, we're a listed company, so we have to be really careful in terms of our, you know, the disclosure legislation that we're subject to, you know, both in the UK where we're listed, but also obviously we come under SEC rules and all the rest of it. So it does make us nervous. It's got to be said. And clearly, the more data, as you sort of demonstrated, the more data, the more granular that data, then, you know, the ELs fall, and therefore, in theory at least, the price that we pay, you know, the risk spread that we pay falls. Not so sure that's necessarily happened on the cyber side, but there we go. But you know, ultimately, you know, that's part of the dream, and that, you know, if we can get to that point where that granularity of data is habitual, then clearly that will help to engender, as Paul was saying, greater investor confidence, and that, you know, hopefully will make the space just that, you know, little bit more attractive. But it's, you know, issuing a bond is complex, really complex, much more complex than any other market, you know, sort of public security I've ever been involved in. That's because of the structure with the SPVs and everything else, so there's just even more documents. So it's complex, it's expensive, it's quite lengthy, and it includes us, as I say, giving away data that we probably prefer not to. So it's anything but ideal at the moment, and I suppose that's kind of why I keep banging on about innovation.
Mm. Yeah, and I completely agree, and I think the sort of the topic we're discussing here about improving operational excellence, it's about improving data transparency, but also improving a lot of the other processes that you mentioned there. So Richard, if I can come back to you and sort of,
yep.
I mentioned a lot about sort of models and the work that we're doing in terms of investing in new models and latest science and incorporating a lot of the changes that we're seeing from the claims data and the legal environment. So what do you feel is going on with model understanding within the market, and what sort of role does that play within the issuance process?
Yeah, so we would contend that the ILS investors that are actively engaged, particularly in the bond side, have a very sophisticated understanding of the models that are being used within the cat bond realm. Many ILS investors today have employed reinsurance underwriters for many, many years, and have equal sort of understanding with respect to what is what are the underlying exposures and the models that are being used to quantify that risk. And so whilst the processes haven't really changed in the last couple of decades, it is fair to say that there is increasing sophistication. And we see it. We see it when we structure transactions and we speak with investors. There's just a very high degree of sophistication. And that's helping us maintain stability within the market, because it's allowing us to come with different types of risks and having very versed and sophisticated discussions with investors on the transactions. And I think where you do see model updates and changes in risk quantification, we're not seeing wild movements in spread levels, because investors already have their views and have an understanding of the risk irrespective of model changes. So in some senses, the investors are increasingly sophisticated in their understanding. I think the question then becomes, and I think where you're going with this is how do we as an industry enable investors to have those multiple views in the most accurate and robust way? And there clearly are areas that we can focus on. I think it was referenced earlier in a couple of the cyber transactions where the underlying data has been provided to multiple risk modelling firms in order to ensure that investors are ultimately getting that very accurate view of risk. And cat bonds are a little bit different to reinsurance, where in reinsurance, a reinsurer will typically get the underlying exposures. They'll get the locations, they'll see everything. In the cat bond world, investors don't receive the underlying exposures. They receive model runs. They see the output. And so, you know, there's just a lot of work that can be done to further improve that transparency.
Yeah. And Paul, so picking up that theme, what would you like to see from us as Moody's to drive that better understanding of models to help you build your own view of risk? We've referenced the cyber transactions where there was sort of data provided to the two modelling firms, ourselves and another one, and within the space. So I guess that was I saw that as a start, but does that help, and how do you think about it?
I absolutely think that helps, and it's something that we would definitely want to see more of, and we definitely applaud the process there. I think it was obviously very, very important for the cyber transactions where you have that, I guess, lower level of confidence in the underlying risk models. They're not as mature, that you haven't had generations of versions of these risk models. And maybe to go to that point, I spent over a decade of my own career building CAT models. That kind of expertise is now sitting with a lot of fund managers, and I know that many of my peers work at competitors. That expertise and understanding of models is something that we really prioritize now. So making sure that we get that access to models which have been run with accurate input is clearly very important. It's very important in terms of cyber because you understand there's going to be that bigger difference between models. You're going to have less certainty around those models. And I think that entire situation also applies to a lot of the sort of, once you move outside of the US, where there is this vast amount of experience of those models, there's a lot of expertise in terms of, a lot of familiarity with those models. Once you move to models such as European flood or other perils in different parts of the world, you have that lower certainty of the overall models to start off with. You have bigger differences between different vendors. In those kind of situations, removing that exposure uncertainty as part of it, making sure that you have transparency there, is really, really important to enable those kind of transactions.
And Hilary, sort of again, sort of on that same theme, and you look at sort of LGT. So, how would you like to see sort of analytics for ILS funds evolve? And how do you think about sort of, I talked in the opening about sort of looking at a lot of the work that we're doing, investing in technology, API-first technology, to integrate it into workflows. How do you think about that within your own workflows, and where can we improve?
Well, maybe just also to add, I think this ILS disclosure, or the disclosure for cat bonds, having multiple model vendors given that data would be extremely useful for, we get these remodelings, and when it's not the official modeling agent who has done the work, it's really apples and oranges. It's a number, but it's really not so useful. So it would be extremely helpful if the disclosure could occur just among model vendors. That would be extremely helpful for investors. In terms of technology for analytics, yes, I think we've had a few discussions with your team, Mike, on the APIs, and that's certainly, we have internally, we have our own portfolio management system, we have our own pricing tool and our own tool for aggregation and the roll-ups. So we're not necessarily looking to the model vendors for this a platform solution. We're looking for ways to integrate the models into our in-house tools, and APIs is certainly something where we're looking for improvement and expansion of the offering. And another thing, you sort of mentioned, not just in the process, but analytics itself, if you look at things like exposure data, that's been discussed for at least 15 years. Why does every model vendor need to have their own format for exposure data? We spend extreme amounts of time across the reinsurance industry downloading, cleaning, managing exposure data, and it's never come together, and that's one thing that would be extremely helpful just in terms of efficiency of the space. That would be a great, just in terms of advancing standards, and I don't know what's hindered that actually going forward over the years, but that would be extremely helpful.
No, we're certainly working on those within our own platform. We can ingest multiple forms of data, so we're data format agnostic. Mm-hmm. You can run third-party models on the platform to ease some of the workload concerns that you had. And I think what we need to do is sort of publicize that more, but to also work with the industry, and particularly ILS funds, to look at where these pain points are, because as I mentioned, we're willing to invest and we're willing to commit to the resources to meet some of those challenges. So mm-hmm. Certainly we can discuss that more. So coming back to you, Richard, And we've talked about sort of liquidity, we've talked about sort of data disclosures and so on. But how do you as sort of Beazley think about engaging with the ILS market, giving increasing risk complexity and areas such as climate change? And do you have a view on, with that in mind, do you have a view on the growth opportunity for the space?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I think we look at it slightly differently between NatCat and cyber, for obvious reasons. It was probably quite unusual we didn't have some form of NatCat ILS. And so from that perspective, it was a pure diversification play and an endeavour, I guess, to keep the traditional market sort of honest. So we essentially placed a bond which sat in, you know, alongside our tower and gave a pricing reference from that perspective. So that was a much more of a kind of general kind of run of the mill, broader reinsurance type conversation and decision. Obviously, on the cyber side of things, you know, it's a hell of a lot different. The traditional market just isn't there in the breadth and depth that we think, you know, ultimately it will need to be if we're going to see the growth that everyone's talking about. So we thought it was kind of beholden upon us, not through any altruistic, you know, desire, but simply from a purely selfish perspective, if we were going to grow and, you know, in line with that market growth and maintain our market share, we needed access to more reinsurance, and that would have to include alternative capital. So we've kind of put the time and the effort into trying to help grow that. I think ultimately it's going to need more people and more frequently to access the ILS space, particularly in cyber, because, you know, investors aren't going to spend the time hiring and training and ultimately paying someone to look at one deal every 3 years. I mean, that's not feasible. So we need, you know, as many people to participate from a sponsor side as possible. But, you know, and as we've seen, you know, the investors also need to spend the time and the ultimately the money on getting people who understand the space or who take the time to understand the space so that they can get comfortable and then ultimately educate their end investors. Because it just has to be kind of that virtuous circle, getting more and more people comfortable with cyber as a class. And then ultimately, therefore, starting to see those you know, percentages. I mean, at the moment, very few funds have the ability to deploy to cyber. And where they do, it'll quite often be a very small percentage. So we need more funds to be able to deploy into that space. We need those percentages to sort of creep up. And, you know, it's kind of what, you know, Paul and Hillary have been saying. It's about confidence. It's about the modelling. I mean, you know, we... Again, not through the goodness of our own hearts, because we're, you know, trying to employ more modelling people. But we paid both for our primary modelling agent, in this case, Moody's RMS, on cyber. But we also paid for CyberCube to provide our potential investors with a second view of risk. And again, we just think that that's at least until, you know, the models converge and they settle down. We think that's kind of important, and therefore, you know, what Hillary is saying about having some form of data room where, you know, a standard set of exposure data goes into it and the primary model that we pay for, they produce their view of what the expected losses are. And then if investors want to then employ modelling, you know, agent two to then, you know, use that data to come up with a different view, you know, kind of happy days, really, as long as the data is, back to your original question about the data sensitivity, as long as it's genuinely secure and, you know, is the confidentiality of that data is respected. I personally don't see a particular problem with that. Obviously, we require, you know, the continued digitization of that data to make it all kind of standard, but that's not beyond the wit of man, I don't think.
Yeah, no, certainly. I guess whenever I talk on these panels or sort of think about our industry, I'm very keen on visions for the next 5 years, and we often do sort of what how risk is changing and so on. So it'd be interesting in looking at the ILS, what you think about the ILS market in the next 5 years. If I can turn to you first, Hilary, I guess sort of we've both been around the industry for a little while and sort of seen sort of some of the developments within the industry. But do you think that we've really made a lot of progress in understanding risk and operationalizing risk management? And how do you see that changing over that next five-year period?
Well, I think, 10 years ago, the model vendors were sort of really, really focused on a platform offering. And I think that's sort of evolved now in time. It seems you're more interested in really offering a use case, tools and services and sort of a use by use basis. And that's certainly a good development. We definitely see, we don't need a full platform offering. That's not what we need. And certainly we would be very happy to see a change in the pricing and, offering that we can make access of. I think that makes more sense for our needs and probably for many others as well. Otherwise, I think it's very important, I was just noticing, looking at these posters here, Verisk, Moody's, all of the key model vendors in the last, I don't know how many years, 5 years or so, were acquired by very large entities, data entities. And I think from our side, certainly one important thing to just emphasize is we really look to you to provide the natural hazard models and risk, and that's something we really would like to see. Don't let that fall behind in these larger organizations. That's something that's what we need you for. That's really the base. And then I think as climate change is, of course, always a big topic, and I think also we've had with almost all the model vendors sort of interactive sessions. Where should we go? What are we looking for with climate change? And then that happened. We had a session, and then we never really heard anything again, and we haven't really seen much coming out. So I think, from our side, it would be really interesting to see more on stress testing, sort of cases, certain events, or, we don't really need a full event set for, but certainly stress testing, if there were more ways to sort of look at stress testing of climate change or sea level rise or sort of these kind of things, I think that would be very, useful and interesting for us.
Yeah. No, because it's interesting. Since we became part of Moody's, I take your point completely, and it's very much sort of top of mind for me that we don't lose sight of our focus on the insurance industry, and we don't lose sight on our core offering around catastrophe risk analytics, because that's if you like, that's why RMS got to the position it did. That's why Moody's acquired RMS, not just for those core capabilities. But it's also sort of quite interesting being part of that broader organization and delivering those core capabilities to other financial institutions. We have 150 banks and asset managers who are using our climate analytics as they originate loans to factor in climate change into sort of the pricing of loans, the pricing of assets. And I think we need to do a better job of tying all of this together, because a lot of those will also be investors within the funds. And I think if we can tie it together around a common currency and a common view of risk and the stress testing you talk about, I think we can sort of create better outcomes.
I think, Mike, if I could just dive in on a quick comment on this, because I think it's definitely seen a trajectory in terms of the core offering and the models which RMS, Moody's RMS and Verisk and others provide. One of the things which has been changing over the last 5 years or so is that the level of transparency that comes with those models. And we've definitely seen improvements in terms of the amount of information you can extract about how the event sets have been created, what their nature of individual storms have been there. That kind of capability is something that it's definitely been a progress, but I think there's definitely more that can be done there, particularly as you think about different kinds of use cases of these models. Things we think about parametrics, for example, that's not a use case. It's a use case we would really like to explore more of, and I think there's a great opportunity there. But the models and the access we have to some of the underlying data in those models is not there yet to really price those transactions accurately. So I think there's definitely more that could be done in terms of model transparency. And also that that additional transparency will allow us to do things like we work with multiple different boutique vendors and smaller vendors who specialize in terms of allowing some of these capabilities about like climate integration, climate stress testing, building scenario views of our view of hurricane risk, for example, which we also integrate in our sort of multi-model philosophy and framework. To do that requires really, really good transparency between to the underlying sort of core transactional models, which are still dominated by Verisk and Moody's. And so we really value that kind of transparency. And so something in terms of how we see that progressing over the next 5 years, I would really like to see a real drive around increased transparency and less concern over some of the IP issues which we sort of butted up against in the past.
Yeah, I think we can certainly take those points into account. And if you look at that, do you feel that coupled with the data flows that we talked about, we'll get to 5 years' time, we'll be in a much better position as an ILS market?
Absolutely, I think we really will. Like, I think we at Securus have invested really, really heavily in our technology and our sort of data and making sure that we have those kind of capabilities that are really embedded into our thinking and our overall process. So when we think about how data flows can improve in terms of all of those kind of things, like that to us, like there isn't, that doesn't scare me in terms of an operational efficiency point of view. Like we have the technology in place which allows us to do that. We feel very comfortable with those kind of changes. So I think overall I'm very confident about that. One thing I would add though, and maybe some of my RMS history is standing out a little bit, but I do wonder if we are being ambitious enough. If I think back to, say, like things like the initiatives which were, what was it, 2018, and the risk data objects initiative, and the idea about an entirely different framework around which data was stored and transmitted around the market, that felt like truly ambitious framework. And this maybe goes to some of the sort of open data standards that Hilary's mentioned as well. I do question if we are being ambitious enough for where we really want to be in 5 years' time. And that maybe applies to some of the thinking about, we, not just cat bonds, but also on reinsurance, also on particularly on things like retrocession, all of that framework could be really revolutionary. And I do question if we are being ambitious enough.
Okay. I share your view on that. And I think we need to constantly push the edge on this, because people in this room are going to be the drivers of that change in future. So, Richard, I think we talked a lot about data, we talked about analytics, we talked about the cat bond issuance process and so on. And you've got a very broad perspective given your role within the industry. So how do you think that the whole industry, the ILS market, when you're sitting there in 5 years' time and we're looking back, what would you hope that we see?
So there's a couple of different angles, right? And we've touched on it. I mean, one is what are the true risk metrics, right? And how do we take into account various factors? One of which is climate change, and how does that mean risk will evolve over time? The other thing that we have to take into account is historical experience. And the cat bond market continues to perform extremely well at the moment. There really hasn't been a lot of principal losses in bonds in recent years. And, those sorts of things need to be taken into account when we look at the overall risk and return relationship of the industry and the quantification of risk. Certainly, if you go back over 20, 25 years, the amount of recoveries that clients have received is far less than the expected loss of transactions. And we would expect that because it's only been around for 20, 25 years as opposed to the 100 years that many of the bonds are ultimately insuring. But these are all the dynamics at play that will determine the overall appropriateness of the covers and the risk profile of the covers that investors are ultimately assuming. But there will clearly be further work in the next 5 years around trying to quantify risk as accurately as possible. And then the other part to it is how is that risk or how do we as an industry articulate the risk? And I do believe there is the potential for more robustness in multiple views of models in particular transactions But to Richard's point earlier, for a client, it's extremely expensive to put deals together, to risk model transactions, and ultimately it will come down to investors and the investors' propensity to sign up for infrastructure and modelling frameworks that that may cost more money in order to get more robustness and multiple views of risk in its full glory. But I do think there will be, you know, we can continue down the same path for the next 5 years, but if investors are demanding multiple views of risk and more robustness, then there's the technology to accommodate that. It's ultimately a game of who pays.
Richard.
Well, you think I pay? Yeah.
I was suggesting the investors pay, Richard, not
you. I tell you, it's felt like that thus far. Yeah. It's got to be said. I'm only teasing.
Yeah. So looking at your 5-year view, I guess, when we talk about sort of the evolution of the market, what are some of the innovations that you'd like to see, and what would those be that would, when you're looking at comparing with your traditional reinsurance and the overall sort of hedging strategy, what would cause you to see more risk to the ILS market over that time?
Well, I suppose in the wishful thinking, probably not likely, cheaper and more simplistic would be lovely. I can't necessarily see how that happens per se, not least of all because of the complexity of the structure I've already sort of touched on. But certainly, you know, the ambition that Paul and Hilary have, that word that's been used, I think if we are ambitious, then, you know, we can create essentially that liquidity which will draw in more investor attention, and that in itself will then move to start creating liquidity. So we've got to get there. I mean, the disadvantages, apart from the ones I've already mentioned, obviously no reinstatement. Now, surely that's possible. Reinstatement is possible in private ILS deals. So how do we structure it so that we can have reinstatement? Because again, yeah, it's great you've got multi-year cover at a relatively known risk spread, obviously subject to model resets and all the rest of it. But, you know, it's once and done. And so, you know, reinstatement is a big advantage that the majority of traditional contracts enjoy. Duration, I mean, most bonds are, you know, three and a bit years. Again, private stuff is much longer. Can we not move to a situation? Why have we always sort of settled around this kind of 3-year structure? Because, of course, once you go to longer durations of the bonds, then you can start to put other risk classes in there. Where obviously the tail is just that much longer, so you just need that longer development period. I think it was Paul touched on ratings. I mean, I remember when I first started looking at ILS back in kind of 2015 and was sort of looking at, and I know there's a massive difference between theory and practice, but in theory, what the EL tells you is then compared to the corporate bond market, and if the EL for a, let's say, what Moody's consider a triple C bond, if that then equates to X as a risk spread, then that's what your EL of Y should equate to. So, you know, and again, you know, you guys are now owned by a rating agency. Presumably there's something that can be done there, because if there is that shortcut, you know, yes, it's all great having an EL, but what exactly does that mean? If a traditional bond investor looks across at this thing and rather than having all of this ILS complexity around it, just sees the fact that this is equivalent to or rated by Moody's as, or whatever it is, as a, you know, as a triple C bond, that potentially provides, again, a much broader audience. Those that don't have either the desire or the, you know, or the resources to hire an entire ILS team. And, yeah, just acceptance. And that's, it's down to us, the sponsors. It's down to, you know, Richard and his gang as structurers. Stan to Paul and Hillary as investors, we've just got to continue to educate people because, you know, for and yeah, sure, it'd be great in the short run if there was a huge raft of pricing ill discipline and suddenly we could get, you know, property cat bonds away at, you know, 2% risk spreads. But of course, that's only in the short run. That doesn't do us any favours. We had that pricing ill discipline. It happened to coincide with obviously a very active hurricane or a unusual, you know, amount of losses. And that really shot the ILS market in the foot. And we're only kind of now recovering, I think, because of, as Rich is saying, you know, the as an asset class, it's performing extremely well. So we need to have that discipline, but we also need to have a, you know, the education and a bit more of an emphasis on the fact that it is a genuinely non-correlating asset class. You can argue whether cyber is a little bit more, a little bit less non-correlating or whatever, but ultimately the correlations are extremely low. You know, and that has to help. And again, in 2015, it was, you know, it was really large, you know, family offices, high net worth individuals, and then obviously, you know, some institutional investors. That audience hasn't changed. That's really the only people that continue to look at this space. So kind of how can we start to bring it more into the mainstream? Sorry, that was a long-winded answer, yeah. But... I think
really
we need to be ambitious.
Yeah. So we've got, I know we're between you and lunch, but we have 10 minutes before lunch is served. So have we got any questions?
Yeah. Thank you very much. I'm interested in this idea of model convergence and investor sophistication. So if I come in as an investor that knows nothing about this and over here, I have 1,000 scientists who say, who give me this risk profile, but over here, I have 1,000 scientists who give me another one. And they're vastly different, then I'm going to begin to feel uncomfortable. And then it was touched on this idea of cyber, this idea of models settling down and gradually converging and coming together. But Paul, you also raised the idea that... that having that nuance is also a differentiator when talking to investors and to say, no, we have a nuanced view. And so if I'm a very sophisticated investor, then I want all the nuance in all the science because I'm going to use you and talk to you and get a view. But if I'm a very unsophisticated investor, then I kind of want in the insurance, all these 2,000 scientists to get together and just tell me what the risk is and just give me a rating. And I guess the particular question is... And I'm specifically thinking about NatCat, and let's take US wind. Have the models converged as much as they ever will do? Are we moving towards more convergence, where there is this unified view? Or are we at the point where that, you know, we have the scientific discourse and there isn't going to be anymore? Or are we moving towards a world where and I'm almost thinking like a large open source NatCat view that we all subscribe to and where the 2,000 scientists get together.
I'm trying to think how to respond to that question. I would say that when you think about sort of the peak peril views of risk, so the, you know, the, which are the dominant piece of, sort of this problem, those models are very sophisticated. They have had multiple generations of those models exist. So, you know, the first models were back developed in the 80s, and you've had iterations of development and process. And to a large extent, I'm not expecting revolutions in those models or revolution in their frameworks. But they have to be used as tools, and they have to be used as they have gaps in what they cover. They have gaps in what they represent. They don't include things like a good representation necessarily of social inflation. They probably don't have a good representation of large-scale infrastructure influences on natural disasters, those kind of things. So, example, like dam failures or power network failures, those kind of post-loss amplification kind of effects. So there's lots of things where you have to be a very sophisticated interpretation of those models. But I think the convergence is, I would argue, largely there for the sort of peak perils. And it will... As these models, as this cat modeling as a discipline, there are more providers now, there are more people working in the space. I would say that much of what we've learned from those, the convergence of those peak peril models, is being adopted in secondary peril models, and those models are evolving quicker and faster than that, the long lead time it took on the sort of the peak peril regions. But having said that, you then have to factor in the climate change problem. And I think that is a big piece of this, is that we need to have confidence that these models are, that the people building these models, and as well the sort of users of these models, are engaged with the scientific community as well, and making sure that there is that connection to the latest thinking around climate change and how that can be represented in these models. And that's where you need that transparency piece that I talked about, Mike, in terms of being able to then formulate your own view of that additional uncertainty within these models. So yeah, it is definitely complicated. We have to recognise that natural catastrophe risk is a complicated problem.
Other questions?
I was reflecting on the fact that in the last few years, cat bond investors haven't suffered significant losses, and I was wondering the extent to which that is fair, particularly from the sponsors' side, and whether that hinders sponsors from issuing more. Thank you.
Well, I think certainly from my side, right now is actually quite a milestone for the cat bond industry. We were looking at it just this morning that there are now 100 different sponsoring entities in the market today. It's 100 different, and that's grown significantly in the last couple of years. The market itself is 18% up year on year, the cat bond market in terms of outstanding notional. So what you're seeing is that entities are coming to market to issue cat bonds because it's still offering them with really important collateralized multi-year capacity that they're not easily finding in other insurance and reinsurance markets. So that the overall value proposition for companies coming to the cat bond market is as good today as it's been in years, and that's despite the higher spreads that investors are seeking in order to assume this level of risk. So I think the overall environment remains super positive, and part of that is due to the investors' ability to articulate the risk that their end allocators are ultimately assuming, and that's off the back of some of the convergence in peak perils, as Paul had just said, but also just years and years of sophistication around how these models are ultimately coming together.
And I'd also say that sort of suddenly in my time with it, in Richard's role and other roles in the market, I think a lot of these bonds are sort of at remote return period levels. So the idea was always the sell to investors who may not know this space is you'll read about it in the front page of the Wall Street Journal. It's not something that is going to be pretty small. So you would expect, if we're operating at that return period, that there are certainly periods of time when we won't get that level of losses. But I think the market can develop to offer much more. Cyber is one, sort of some of the what we used to call secondary perils or others, where we need a more education about those very complex risks. But I think we can cross that chasm in the same way that we did with CAT and natural hazard and quake.
And I think we have, Michael. I mean, if we just look at the last couple of years, we've seen risk from New Zealand. We saw parametric transactions this year from Mexico, Jamaica, Puerto Rico. We've seen an influx of European-based transactions that have come to market in the last 18 months. We've seen over $500 million of cyber come to market in the last little while. So the market is expanding beyond where it's been, and a lot of this is supply and demand. It's around what are the other options these sponsoring entities have, but it's expanding. The market is growing.
Yep.
There was one word I picked up on which I thought was quite interesting. You said, "Is it fair?" And I just think that the answer is there's no fairness in markets, full stop. These are commercial transactions, and if you bought cover and it didn't work, then you just bought the wrong cover, and vice versa. You know, and so there are ways you can manage that. You can worry about basis risk. You can look at where it's placed in your tower. You can look at what you're covering. You can look at what you're paying. But ultimately, there's no kind of fairness in it. In the same way that I think in the previous question, you know, tell me what the answer is. Tell me what the risk is. We just don't know. And I think the problem is that, and this isn't necessarily just an ILS thing, but everyone talks about the market. I mean, just lots of people have talked about the market, and we give it these kind of superhuman qualities, and they just don't exist. It is not a moral entity, and therefore it doesn't understand fairness, and it is not perfect either. You know, no asset class, you know, no asset market is fair. It's just a series of transactions. It just doesn't care about fairness, and it doesn't really care about the answer because it's not trying to give you the answer. You've got to sort of figure out, and we've got to figure out, if that's the cover, what are we prepared to pay for it? And if it's too much, we won't do it. And if it looks cheap, we'll buy loads of it. And we might be wrong and we might not, you know, who knows? You know, in the same way that I remember sitting down with a climate modelling person when I was trying to understand this space and said, but I understand why the hurricane forms, but why is it going to Miami and not into, you know, Tampa or whatever? And they're like, we don't know. We simply don't know. We have no idea. It can be barreled along and it turns right for totally random reasons. And so I think that we've got to understand that we are dealing with all of these things with randomness. You know, on the cyber, it's slightly different because it's about human actions quite often when it comes to things like ransomware and data theft and all the rest of it. And more often than not, as we've just discovered, a good old-fashioned human cock-up. But, you know, so that's a bit more human. But NatCat, it's, you know, the hurricane doesn't care where you live. It doesn't really care where it's going. It just is. It's just a hurricane.
Which is why investors ultimately earn a multiple of that expected loss. So if the expected loss is 1%, you're generating 5 or 6%, you know, that is seeking to assume the volatility Richard's referring to.
Or if your expected loss is 2 and you're generating 18%, then...
Yes.
Correct.
Correct.
Just saying, for a friend.
Sure, that discussion can continue over lunch. So with that, I think we're at time. But if you could just thank the panelists, I think it's been a great session.